This is Age of Treason Radio.
First thing I remember was asking Papa why. For there were many things I didn't know.
On the White Network. With your host, Dan Stoffel.
Welcome, everyone. The title of tonight's installment is Guilt and Pride. The last time I talked about a nobody named Shannon Corwin, who had made a comment saying that it was okay to be proud of being French, German, Irish, or whatever, but understand there is no pride in simply being white. And I want to address that in more detail tonight. She, of course, I pointed out, didn't think people of color were a myth. It was only white people, white identity, white racial pride that she's opposed to. And as I said, she's a nobody, and she's just parroting a myth that was concocted by somebody else. But there are other people who are more influential, who have said very similar things, and I want to cite a couple of examples that I've discovered. One that I found is very popular on the internet is a bit of a skit from the comedian George Carlin, and he talks a bit about national and ethnic pride. And he starts his skit by saying, "I saw a slogan on a guy's car that said, 'Proud to be an American.' And I thought, what the does that mean? I've never understood national pride. I've never understood ethnic pride. I'm Irish. All four of my grandparents were Irish. And when I was a kid, I would go to the St. Patrick's Day parade and they sold a button that said, 'Proud to be Irish.' But I knew that on Columbus Day, they sold the same button that said, 'Proud to be Italian.' Then came Black Pride and Puerto Rican Pride, and I could never understand ethnic or national pride because to me, and this is where it gets interesting, to me, pride should be reserved for something you achieve or attain on your own, not something that happens by accident of birth. Being Irish isn't a skill. It's a genetic accident. You wouldn't say, 'I'm proud to be 5'11". You wouldn't say, 'I'm proud to have a predisposition for colon cancer.'" He goes on a little bit and then wraps up by saying, "If you're happy, that's fine. Happy to be an American, be happy. But don't be proud. There's too much pride as it is, and remember, pride goeth before a fall." So I see a pattern here between Carlin and Shannon Corwin. And the pattern is that they like dictating to other people how they should feel about something, and they try to soften it or pair it up, disguise it a bit, by also giving license to do something else instead, as if that lessens the dictating that they're trying to do. And, you know, either way, it's arrogant, as if anyone needs George Carlin's approval as to how they're going to identify, what group they're going to identify with, or even to be happy. It's one thing I'd like to point out is that he says quite openly that he doesn't understand it. He doesn't understand ethnic or national pride. And I don't think he does. I don't think he understands pride. But I'll get to that after I talk a little bit more about some of the other points I want to make. American, he starts off with American. And I think that's really what he was attacking was American identity. And these days it's easy to attack American identity. It's sort of like kicking a dead carcass. At one point, American really was a nationality. It was a coalescing nationality, or you could even say it was a fully developed nationality, and it had a meaning to it. But it's since been debased and diluted, and now it's pretty much reduced down to a nation of immigrants. Ironically, nowadays, to be an American, all that you need is an accident of birth to be born inside of U.S. borders, and it doesn't even require a genetic link anymore. So, you know, at least I could say on the good side, at least he made the sort of racist connection that ethnicity and nationhood is genetic in basis. But on the bad side, he totally denigrated a person's genetic makeup by calling it an accident. And it's not an accident, of course. It's every one of us, every human being, is the product of generations of men and women who, for the most part, were proud of themselves, proud of the communities they lived in, and carefully selected who they married, who they reproduced with. And really, the most selfish and guilt-ridden, the ones that didn't have pride, gave up and didn't reproduce, and their line ended long ago. So that's that line about being a genetic accident is really off base. If he doesn't want to be proud to be Irish, that's fine. But he's attacking other people for feeling some sense of Irish identity, and beyond that, Italian identity and American identity. And he really has no place to do that. And he does it in the, you know, by making it sound like it's stupid. But really, he's the stupid one. He's billed as a comedian, or was until he died. Made his living doing that. But in this skit in particular, I'll link to it so you can go listen to it yourself, hear it and present it live. It was toward the end of his life, toward the end of his career. And it really isn't funny. It's more of a social criticism, and it's poisonous. It's comes across as really hateful and ignorant, literally ignorant. White pride is already pathologized. It really was not necessary to do what he did. And, you know, throwing in black pride and Puerto Rican pride, that may have been what he was obliquely trying to do, was somehow poke at them. But it wasn't very effective, and the focus there was on European-centric identity. So, you know, George Carlin was not the first person to say this. He wasn't the originator of the idea either. And I found also a fellow named Arthur Schopenhauer, who had a famous quote that a lot of people like to cite on the same subject. He said it a little bit more intelligently. Pay attention. The cheapest form of pride, however, is national pride, for it reveals in the one thus afflicted, the lack of individual qualities of which he could be proud, while he would not otherwise reach for what he shares with so many millions. He who possesses significant personal merits will rather recognize the defects of his own nation, as he has them constantly before his eyes, most clearly. But that poor blighter who has nothing in the world of which he can be proud latches on to the last means of being proud, the nation to which he belongs. Thus he recovers and is now in gratitude, ready to defend with hands and feet all errors and follies which are its own. Arthur Schopenhauer, a very famous German philosopher, died in 1860. I don't know when he made this statement exactly. He was an influence on Nietzsche and Wagner and other famous thinkers. So he can't be dismissed like George Carlin can, as ignorant. But I think he is mistaken. And I think in looking at his wiki page, at his biography, I'm no expert on Schopenhauer or his thinking, so I'm not going to criticize him too deeply. But I did find something that gives some hint as to what the basis was for him feeling this way. And I think he was really simply projecting his own basic desires onto all of mankind, and that he had these feelings of futility exactly because he didn't want to identify with his nation, with a larger group. So he was all alone, a man all alone, who felt the futility of that rather than the power that he could have felt with a national identity. And the way he went about denigrating national pride is the same way that to this day you can see this on forums all across the internet when nationalists deal with their critics. We're faced with this attack that we're just stupid, that we're ignorant, and we're losers, and that's why we try to have a larger identity with a larger group, is because to somehow make up for our own personal defects. Well, I know from my own case that that's not true. I'm quite happy with my life and what I've accomplished so far in it. So I've always known that that was a load of crap when people tried to use that argument on me. But I know it is a common argument. And we see the source here. There are even great thinkers who have said as much discounted pride. Well, an interesting thing about pride, I thought I understood what the word pride meant, and I didn't understand that there were two senses to the word. And when I looked it up, the Wikipedia has a page for pride, and it actually describes it as having two senses. It says, pride is an inwardly directed emotion that carries two common meanings. With a negative connotation, pride refers to an inflated sense of one's personal status or accomplishments, often used synonymously with hubris. In other words, it's another word for hubris. With a positive connotation, pride refers to a satisfied sense of attachment toward one's own or another's choice and actions, or toward a whole group of people, and is a product of praise, independent self-reflection, or a fulfilled feeling of belonging. In other words, there is a bad meaning to the word, which is exactly what George Carlin mistakes as the good meaning for the word. George Carlin described, you know, this personal accomplishment, which is really hubris, which is really the bad sense. And the good sense of the word is the group sense, the group identity, the feeling of pride that comes from a healthy identity with a larger group of people, and that common sense of belonging that solves or answers some need in most of us psychologically. No man is an island. We need others to help us get through life. We're not born by our own hand, and we're not buried by our own hand either. I think Schopenhauer missed that too, and perhaps his statement was motivated a bit by hubris too. In fact, you know, it takes an inflated sense of yourself and your own accomplishments in order to criticize that other sense, that the belonging to a larger group. You have to have an inflated sense of your own abilities to think that you could get along without a larger group to belong to. A larger group of like-minded and like-kinded people. So the Wikipedia page goes on. There's, of course, a twist. It's Wikipedia, after all. It mentions that pride can also manifest itself as a high opinion of one's nation, national pride, and ethnicity, ethnic pride. But there's a twist. The article continues, and it's the usual Jewish cultural Marxist twist, that when it comes to whites, there's a big exception. A little further down on the page, in a section titled Ethnic Pride, which I think it really honestly should be called Racial Pride, because it talks about Asian pride and black pride and then white pride, and it contrasts them. And Asian pride, it says nice things about Asians and how Asian pride formed during colonialism, when Europeans controlled 85% of the world's land through colonialism, and it resulted in anti-Western feelings amongst Asian nations. And today, Asians still look upon European involvement. Well, there's the litany of sins and the consequence of it, that, you know, that blaming white people for what we've done collectively, and it actually helps Asians have a common sense of identity for themselves. This is identity politics that I've talked about before. With black pride, it's very similar. It says the slogan black pride has been used by African Americans to denote a feeling of self-confidence, self-respect, celebrating one's heritage, and being proud of one's personal worth. Black pride as a national movement is closely linked with the developments of the American Civil Rights Movement. And the point I want to make is that both of these, when it's talking about both of these, it's not pathologizing them, it's not demonizing them, it's not saying they're bad, it's just talking about them as if they're normal. Then we get to white pride. And it describes white pride, right after the other two, as a slogan used primarily in the United States to agitate for a white race identity and is traditionally closely aligned with white supremacy, white separatism, and other extreme manifestations of white racism. It has a link then, too, to a special page just about white pride. And that page describes white pride as a slogan indicating pride in being white. The slogan has been adopted by neo-Nazi and white supremacist organizations. White pride advocates claim that there is a cultural double standard in which only certain ethnic groups are permitted to openly express pride in their heritage, and that white pride is not inherently racist and is roughly analogous to racial positions such as Asian pride, black pride, and non-racial forms such as gay pride. Gay pride is also mentioned in the general article about pride. It cites then under a section called Criticism, philosopher David Ingram, who argues that affirming black pride is not equivalent to affirming white pride, since the former, unlike the latter, is a defensive strategy aimed at rectifying a negative stereotype. By contrast, affirmations of white pride, however, thinly cloaked as affirmations of ethnic pride, serve to mask and perpetuate white privilege. So here in this one article, it's saying basically that whites are imagining, white advocates are imagining, they're claiming that there's a cultural double standard. And it's right here in the very article that they're citing, and as well as in the more general article about pride in general. And white people, white advocates realize it. I'm not the first one, and I won't be the last. When I think about my own sense, oh, by the way, Wikipedia disagrees with Carlin, George Carlin. The only problem that they have is with white pride. Black pride is okay, Asian pride's okay. Even gay pride is okay with Wikipedia. So they don't think it's all stupid like Carlin tries to make it sound. But when I think about my own sense, my own feelings of white identity and white pride, I can see elements of these things that are mentioned for other people. These fulfilled feeling of belonging, the group confidence, group respect, celebrating one's heritage, being proud of the group's worth, at least when I look in retrospect or to the future as a potential for us, because right now what we have isn't good. We are a people, a collection of ethnies, nations, and collectively as a race who are in retreat. We're on the defensive, and our group identities are all under attack and for the most part in tatters. So it's not good for us. And most of us act as if our identities have been discredited and that we don't want to identify with them. We go to great lengths to avoid talking about it and to avoid identifying. And some even take up the opposite side and argue that that nobody should, that we shouldn't identify as white or even as proud of our nation or our ethnic. So an important point here, in fact, I put it in the title, is this contrast between guilt and pride. And I've talked a lot about guilt previously. And as I said, I wanted to move into more positive aspects of white identity. And I think pride is one aspect of it. In fact, pride and guilt are opposites. And they are literally opposites. The more time and energy you expend feeling guilty about yourself or your group is the less that you can feel pride in it. And for myself, once I recognized the anti-white guilt tripping as guilt tripping, as guilt that was being laid on whites by other hostile groups, and in particular Jews, then it was easy. When I realized it was coming from outside of whites primarily, it was easy to reject it. And pride, or at least the tempered pride that I just previously described there, welled up naturally in its place. At the same time, I guess I could say it in another way, that it was this increasing sense of pride that I was having, this sense of belonging to a larger group, that made me feel protective and defensive of it and recognize the attacks in the first place, the attacks on white identity and whites as a group, as including me, as attacks on me. And that helped me with my racial consciousness. And in fact, I've used the expression racial consciousness before to describe that I lacked a racial consciousness before, and I have one now. And I think that was kind of mistaken. I think, just to get my terminology straight here, that I've talked before about this spectrum of antipathy to apathy to empathy, that it's really a continuum like that, that you have your enemies who express racial antipathy versus myself when I was inactive, when I was sitting on the bench, I was racially apathetic. I didn't care about my group and didn't recognize it versus where I am today is not so much racially conscious as it is racially conscious in a positive way. I'm racially empathetic. I empathize with my group. So I'll spend the last few minutes I have here, about 10 minutes or a little less, talking about a story, I think, which is a sign of hope. It's also an illustration of the kind of arguments and the situation and tactics that I've been discussing in this series of podcasts. It concerns an incident, a recent incident that happened at Towson University in Maryland, I believe. And it was triggered by a fellow named Matthew Heimbach. And there's a bit of a history there that he's a student and had previously been a member of Youth for Western Civilization, an organization, sort of a crypto pro-white organization. And he came out with an explicitly pro-white, a proposal for an explicitly pro-white organization, a white student union. And he wrote a letter to the school newspaper, and they published it in the paper. I'll link to that, and I don't want to say too much about that. It's a very brief letter calling for a white student union and citing a few reasons why he thought it was necessary. He cited South Africa, the genocide in South Africa, and anti-white assaults in our own country. And he ended it with the statement, "We must protect the security of Europeans and a future for the next generation," which echoes the 14 words. This was followed a few days later by a follow-up story in the same paper, not written by Heimbach, but interviewing him and interviewing others reacting to his call. And this is very interesting. There is something I'd like to read here. One of the statements from somebody who was against it, music education major named Liam Hurlbut, said, "White power movements are illegitimate. In the history of this country, whites never lost their power. They have always run this country and oppressed all other races. Even today, whites have unearned privileges in our society. Whites must recognize and reject this privileges to atone for the evils of our ancestors." That captures in a nutshell, it's almost a caricature. It's almost a joke. It makes a joke of the what the other side, what our enemies have been saying about whites. And I think it's not intended as a joke. I think it's just because this is what a relatively young college student, how he's digested it, how he's boiled it down, the message that he's gotten and how he expresses it. But I think it lays it out there that it can be interpreted that way, that this is how serious it is. This is the idea that people get in their heads when they're presented with this idea of identity, as I've described identity politics being that all non-whites are okay to have an identity, and that identity is that white people have oppressed them, and that for that reason, white people, the only identity they're allowed to have is as oppressors and as people who need to atone for those sins of their ancestors. So in response, there was some lively commenting on all of these pieces. This one in particular, I was impressed with some of the comments that came back. One talked about cultural Marxism and noted that the four main aspects are whiteism is racism, maleness is sexism, heterosexuality is homophobia, and gentility is antisemitism. If you're an unrepentant white male heterosexual Gentile, then you might as well have horns. You are the cultural Marxist's devil. And that's, I got at that a little bit in my bit on pathologization and demonization. It's absolutely true. That's what they do. They pathologize and demonize white identity and the white race as a whole. There was another, I'm not going to quote lots and lots of people here. There were several different types of responses, and some of the more common ones. Let me at least characterize them. One of the common ones was, you don't need it, and this was captured in Liam's comment, you don't need a white organization because whites already have everything else. For instance, the school administration is mostly white people. And it's really an inverted, unsympathetic description of the reality, which is that whites are strongly discouraged from having any sort of identity. Everyone is us. We're not allowed to discriminate. We can't have any other. Everyone is us. And our responsibility is to create a safe society or a safe university for everyone else to have their student unions in, but not us. Another typical response was, hey, I'm white. I'm really, really white, and therefore I can't be anti-white. This is almost always a red flag. I've seen this many times before in such discussions. It's a claim for moral authority as a member of our in-group, right? It's somebody saying, I'm white, and therefore I should be given extra credence because of that. And then their whole point is that the group is immoral. So they use the moral authority to undermine the group itself. And it's a trick. Speaking of tricks, that was another kind of response. There was one fellow who got really upset because he said, to say that if blacks can have it, then whites should have it too, is a word trick. Do not fall for it. Blackness and whiteness are not symmetrical definitions. Blackness is defined by possession of a black ancestry. Whiteness, on the other hand, is defined not by possession of white ancestry, but by non-possession of non-white ancestry. This is similar to what the critic of white identity, white pride, was saying. Let me see, what was his name? David Ingram, that philosopher, that white and black aren't equal. And it's funny, the way they describe it, of course, is white and black aren't equal because blacks are treated worse, as they're telling you that whites aren't allowed to do something that blacks are. And they're explaining to you that about white privilege, a situation in which it's blatantly clear that blacks are the ones, or non-whites are the ones, who are privileged. They're the ones who get to have student unions organized for their best interests. I'm going to jump to my conclusion here because I've got quite a bit to say. You know, it doesn't have to be this way. We can find all the righteous anger and energy we need in the realization that we've been wronged here, that we've been defrauded. The idea that race doesn't exist, that identity doesn't exist, is wrong. As I've shown several times, it's only white people that it's intended to be swallowed by. It's intended to mislead us. It's intended to demoralize us, to disarm us. And just because you don't realize a fraud at the beginning doesn't mean that when you finally do realize it, you don't do anything about it. The reality is that there's a war that's been exposed here in this realization, a war by other groups who are organized as groups against us as a group. And this is how racial identity crystallizes, and this is how mine crystallized. It was due to the recognition of this threat to my group from others. And I'm confident that we can defeat our enemies, but we have to identify and organize as whites.